coming to you from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, by way of Stone Mountain, Georgia, birthed by the great state of South Carolina, is the Bryant Land Country Podcast, your place for any and everything in hunting, fishing, sports, and outdoor related, with heavy doses of randomness, guests, and an all-around good time. Here's your host, proud Gamecock, South Carolina forever, AB3.
All right, now, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Bryant Land Country Podcast. I'm your host, AB3. Thank you for joining us another week on the podcast, man. This thing's rolling along. You guys are responding to the content, the media, if you will, that I am putting out. Got great feedback on last week's episode with the Marshes, Antonio and Kim Marsh. You guys have responded really well to it, seemed to have loved that episode. So I just want to take the time to say thank you. Thank you for supporting the podcast. I really don't have a whole lot that I need to talk to you guys about this week before we get into the guests. So we're going to get right to it. Our guest this week, Ryan the Buddha. Ryan is a combat veteran, a Marine, and Ryan came to me basically from another friend of mine that's a co-worker with me on the Milwaukee Bucks broadcast. And he had been kind of telling me about Ryan for a while and just kind of, you know, the things that Ryan's into, as far as like the things that he does out here in the hunting world and whatnot. And I finally got a chance to talk to Ryan. And then you want to talk about the 6 degrees of separation, if you will. Ryan talked to last week's guest, Antonio Marsh, about putting together some things, some hunts and whatnot. And I had just talked to Antonio right before I finally got in touch with Ryan and lined him up to come on the podcast. So 6 degrees of separation going on here in the Bryant Land Country podcast. But Ryan and I had a good time. We had a good conversation. So I'm very happy to get a chance to present this to you guys. So you guys that listen on the regular, you know the drill. I'm going to fall back and I'm going to let Ryan the Buddha take over my conversation with Ryan the Buddha on the Bryant Land Country podcast. Ryan the Buddha Baldwin, how's it going, brother?
Good. How are you?
Man, I'm doing great. Just glad to be off the road here for a little bit. Did a Bucks game last night, and now I'm talking to you. So I'm doing pretty good.
Sounds good. I'm excited.
Thank you. So first thing, Buddha, your nickname. Where did that come from?
I mean, I'm kind of a meathead, muscular, bearded, not a fat guy. So people always ask where it comes from. And at boot camp, the drill instructor asked me how to pronounce my last name. And I said, Baldwin, sir. And he said, Buddha. And I said, Baldwin, sir. And he said, Buddha. And I said, Buddha, sir. And then he said, that was easy, wasn't it? And so it stuck pretty hard after that. Pretty much everybody, except for my parents, have called me that since then.
Nice. Nice. Now, you say boot camp. What branch and where did you serve?
I was in the Marine Corps from enlisted in 1999 and got out in 2006 and was all over the place and one pump in Iraq in 04 and 05.
Wow. Wow. Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
What made you wanted to join the Marines?
I'd always been interested in military service. I come back from a long line of veterans in my family, actually all the way back up to Battle of Bunker Hill. There was some people on my dad's side that fought there. And the Marine Corps was the biggest draw to me just because it was an attitude thing. It was a confidence, almost to the point of cockiness, but they back it up. And I wanted that.
Nice. Now, going back before you got into the Marine Corps, as far as like with your hunting and stuff, is that something that you grew up doing? Was that something that came to you like later via your service? Or, well, first of all, let's back up. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Door County, just north of Green Bay. Was there until I was 18 and left for the Marines. So, I mean, pretty rural. I mean, town of 9,000 people. I mean, so hunting definitely was part of it. My father didn't hunt, though. I had buddies. It was a yearly deer camp and then opportunistic hunting, guys just going out and shooting squirrels and rabbits, and it wasn't anything really intense, or it wasn't really a lifestyle. It's just something that you did. It didn't grow into that until after the service.
Gotcha. And in Green Bay, obviously Green Bay, Wisconsin. How old were you when you first started?
Probably 13. I think I shot my first deer. You know, even though my dad didn't hunt, he went with me though. And he was there when I shot my first doe. And that was important to me that he was with me. He didn't have any idea what he was doing. I didn't have any idea what I was doing, but we did it together. And the family part of it is something I try to continue with my stepdaughters and now my son that's coming.
Awesome. Awesome. And congratulations on your son that's coming up. It's funny, you know, you say you didn't know what you're doing. Your dad didn't know what he was doing. It's kind of like that commercial where the guy is out and he's like, you know, today we shot a rocket. The kid's like, today we shot a rocket. And then dad's like, we attempted to blow up the house. And like, just the different perspective, like the kid's all excited.
Absolutely.
And dad's just like, we're trying to get through
this
thing. That's
money.
So, man, that's great. Now, are you an only child? Are you brothers and sisters, or did they hunt with you? Or
I have a younger sister and then a younger brother. My brother and I hunted, a little bit when I got home, and then now that I'm in it so much with all the cameras and the social media stuff, when I hunt with him, he's like, "Are you gonna film it?" I was like, "No, man, I'm just gonna sit here and we're gonna make fun of each other." I mean, it's nice to hunt with him, just to hunt,
right? Right. No, that's another thing too. In the same way, it's like when I go home to watch my son or my daughter, they play baseball and softball, and they're like, "Are you gonna take pictures? Like, are you gonna shoot it and stuff?" Because obviously with my sports background and directing live TV sports, they're like, "Are you gonna film our at bats? Are you gonna shoot our at bats?" I'm like, "No, I just want to be a parent. I just want to sit and I just want to watch. Like, I don't want to have to worry about all the stuff that comes along with that." So I totally understand that from that standpoint. Before we get into your show and the stuff that you got going on, filming and that kind of stuff, when you were in the service, did it allow you to do a lot of hunting? Did you get to hunt different states or different places? And obviously not Iraq, but maybe other places that you were at while you were in the Marine Corps?
I didn't. I don't have a lot of regrets in life, and being 18, 19, through 25-year-old Marine infantry, when you're not in the field or not deployed, I mean, it was basically party time. And I didn't utilize, I lived in California for 3 years and never went up to see any of the national parks or anything like that. And I kind of regret that. But, that was a time to go out with your guys when you're not yelling at each other in training and let off some steam. So I didn't really utilize, those opportunities then. I did shoot a turkey in Iraq. But it was a farm turkey. We bought it from the farmer, but we snuck up on that thing and shot it. And what did I get? Now I've completed the Grand Slam, and I always say that, when I get the World Slam, I'll be the World Slam with an asterisk. Because I got one in Iraq.
Nice. Now, wait a minute. How did that come about? I know you said you got it from a farmer, but, when most people think of Iraq, they just think of, desert and just nothingness. Like, how did that go down?
All these big palm groves, like, they're estates. There's a sheikh that owns everything, and there's, it's almost like feudalism, where there's farmers underneath him, and they'd own these big groves, and there'd be turkeys running around everywhere in there. And I kept asking my squad leader, I was like, man, can I shoot one of those? And he's like, no, dude, those are owned by the farmer. I mean, that's their subsistence. So finally, we got out on a patrol where, to admit, we really didn't have a lot of supervision. And I asked him, he's like, all right. He's like, you got to go talk to the farmer. So I had gone to school, a language school for Arabic before I deployed. So I walked up and I convinced this farmer for 20 U.S. American dollars, which is a pile of money to them, I'm going to shoot your turkey and I'll give it back to you so you guys can eat it. And we went and shot it and fanned it out. And then we took a picture just like you would, send in to the field and stream, and then gave it back to him. Right. And he looked at us like, these people are crazy.
I was about to say, was that a tough sale? Was the $20 like, was that what took it over? Or like,
I think he was more shocked that, like, you're going to give me $20 and then you're going to give me my turkey back. And I mean, they ate it and everything. It was,
wow.
I didn't want to take their food from them.
Sure. Did he share it to you? Like, was there like a camaraderie, or was it just kind of like, all right, whatever you want to do, just give me the $20 so I can get you away from here.
It was like, pay me and go away. I mean, the quizzical look on his face, I'll never forget. He's just like, are you for real? Like, yeah, we're for real.
Wow.
And we shot some ducks and stuff too. No. We shot some ducks out of the canals. We ate those, and then another guy shot some species of desert fox that I've never looked up exactly what it was. He shot that while everybody else was sleeping, and so gunshots go off, and everybody's
okay.
You know, grabbing their rifle and throwing their flak on, and he's like, he radios back. He's like, I got a fox. You know, like, thanks, dude. We just went to, you know, threat level.
I was about to say all that commotion only to find out that it was just a fox.
Yeah, he was pretty proud of himself.
But. Now, it's funny, though, that you mentioned, like, the waterfowl over there, because I'm in a waterfowl group, and I see a lot of pictures from guys overseas where they're like shooting ducks and all kind of stuff. What's that waterfowl like over there? I'm assuming it's completely different than what we're used to, you know, like in the southern states or in the Midwest, right?
I mean, you get some of the same species, but when you start looking at essentially Eurasian species, there's a lot of different ones. Eurasian widgeon and teal. I think there was a smew, which is the oddest looking duck. It's a white duck with a black tuft. It was just beautiful. I've actually got invited to go hunt in Pakistan with these guys, and it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of rules, but I mean, there's not a whole lot of rules in Pakistan, period. And right. I turned it down. I was like, I don't need to do a Jim Shockey type thing where you get picked up in Jalalabad Airport and put in a trunk and hauled off to the hunting location. And then
the
I was like, I'll
spot.
Pass on that. I had my fill.
Yeah, that's where, and I think that's where a lot of those pictures I've seen come from Pakistan, because like you see, you know, our limits here compared to the pictures I've seen are really modest. Like these guys are like racking up, and I mean, from the looks of it, I mean, it's not like a whole lot of cover, you know. They're definitely not camoed out, you know, with a bunch of calls and stuff. So it was just fascinating to me, and it's kind of like, okay, what's going on over there? Like what are you guys doing? So did you hunt out of a blind, or were you just...
One guy sent me a video. They're underway. I mean, like the motor's full tilt, and there's two guys on the front of the boat, and they're just whacking them as they drive. I mean, it didn't seem like there's a whole lot of sport and challenge to it. I mean, I would have gone to shoot and experience the different culture and the different species, but I mean, it's like shooting a turkey with a rifle. I'm not into that. It didn't have a draw to me. And they added, you know, here in a country that doesn't really like Americans, factor, it was enough to say no to.
Right, right. No, I totally get that. So you get out of the service, you come home. What kind of work were you doing when you got out of service? Did you dive right into like media and photography and all of that? Or what did you do?
What's crazy about, I mean, how I got into film is in high school I mean, this is analog paddles type, you know, archaic equipment, VHS and, you know, dual track audios and recording stuff over the top. I made a bunch of videos and actually had a class that I pitched to the administration, film and media studies. And we got one of the teachers that was kind of, you know, one of the cool teachers to sponsor it. And all we did was make comedies that were really pushing the border of content. And, you know, like when the movies would air, they would, we would be in the office. So I would do a bunch of that. And I was really into it. And I actually had spoke to my father about going into film, and he looked at me, and my dad was kind of the Red Foreman, you know, that 70s show type. He looked at me and he's like, you're going to be another bartender or waiter in LA, you dumbass. You know, like, so he kind of discouraged me from doing it.
Wow.
And I
completely dismissed it.
Huh? That, though. Well, I mean, you either make it or you don't. And right. I don't think I had the skills as a person outside of, you know, filming talents to accomplish what I wanted to do at that point in my life. And kind of glad I went the route I did and came back to it. I mean, I didn't pick the camera up. I mean, I went to college basically just to play rugby, got a history degree, taught high school for a year, and then worked for the government in an office job for 8 years until I started really getting back into hunting. And then I picked up a still camera. Mm-hmm. And that's what propelled me back into film. I was taking pictures of ducks as they migrate north, and my photos got noticed by an acquaintance of mine on Facebook. And he said, hey, I need somebody to film. You know what you're doing? I said, not a clue. Let's go. And the rest is history. I bought equipment, taught myself stuff on YouTube, used the resources I had, you know, amongst friends that I knew that knew more than I did, and just basically became a knowledge sponge, learning everything I could from every source I could get it until
nice,
I got to here.
Nice. Where'd you end up going to college?
I went to UW-Milwaukee.
Okay. Okay. Right down here. Nice. So you pick up the still camera, the guy gets you to start shooting, and you know, you're shooting photos and stuff. Then obviously that led to more opportunities. Like, was there like a gap, or what happened between, you know, shooting the stills and stuff to blowing up and like, okay, let's go, you know, full tilt and all that kind of stuff?
Well, the acquaintance I'm talking about is Patrick Cummings, and he's a guide.
Okay.
I mean, he's been guiding since he was 17, 18 years old. I mean, in elk camps in some of the most remote regions in Wyoming. And I mean, he mainly does waterfowl now, but I mean, he did everything, hogs and turkeys. And he saw that, you know, I had the ability to take the stills, and he, you know, had been following my personal page and saw that I hunted. He's like, I need somebody that can film and knows what's going on. And he had been picked up with this team that I'm part of now, which is called Backcountry Traditions. And it was a fledgling loose association of people from Michigan to Texas to Virginia to, I mean, Pennsylvania, all over the place. And I was the last person to be brought on. And we just started filming. And then we finally got our shot on Pursuit Channel with Blaine Anthony, the Bear Whisperer, was the host of a show called The Den. And there was four teams competing, and the winner gets their own show. And we won. I mean, it was like a what now thing. And I'm not somebody that gets comfortable in where I'm at. I'm always hungry. And we brought in people and upped our filming game. And again, you know, being that knowledge sponge and continuing to learn, we brought in a guy by the name of Josh Stabenow. And he's from my hometown, and he had filmed for some high level stuff. He's Emmy nominated, and the preparation before a hunt changed everything. Before, we would just show up and film it, and whatever we got. And I mean, there's outlines and pre-production meetings, and every single person that's involved in a hunt is involved in the planning. So when you get there, you hit the ground running, you've got multiple cameramen, and all that stuff we filmed with Josh this last 2 years is airing this April and this May, which is our first season solo from the rest of the competition. So it's been a absolute whirlwind. I look back and I look at some of the stuff I first filmed, and I was like, holy cow, how did this happen?
Now, with the, I'm going to get into the production meetings because that's right up my alley, but like with the den and stuff, that was just kind of like you're doing it, you're doing your thing, you know, you're going on your hunts, you film, you're basically putting your idea together, and then you're just bringing it back, and it's judged against the other three contestants or the other three teams?
Yes. I mean, it was judged by whatever panel they had put together plus the at-home audience vote. And our ground game on social media, I think, it was the game changer in that. And, you know, as much as I hate it, I love the connections it brings me. And we've built a fan base, I mean, for lack of a better term. And it was all people we'd hunted with and their friends and our families and friends. And it just kept, like, snowballing into it. Awesome. We've got this solid population of people that are in our corner. It's been really cool to be a part of.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I like about now with social media and just the access to equipment to be able to do things is a lot better than it was back in the day. I mean, you know, back in the day, like you were saying, you go out with your VHS. I mean, hell, when I was in college, we were still shooting on a 3/4 where you had like the 3/4 camera, then you had the separate deck. So you had to have the deck on your shoulder and then you're shooting with the camera. Like I can't imagine folks shooting hunts and, you know, stuff like that back in the day. But, you know, now with social media and, like I said, access to equipment, it makes it a lot easier to build a following. It makes it a lot easier to get your stuff out there. You don't have to just sit around and wait to be noticed. You know, you can go out, put your stuff out, and then if it's good, you build a following, and then things happen for you. So that's one of the things, you know, like you said, I really like about social media as well. It's kind of what I've been trying to do with my brand here. But the production meetings, I want to get you to talk about those a little bit. Like, is this taking place like at the hunt camp, or y'all sitting around, you know, beforehand, like on a conference call? Are you plotting out like cameras? Like what are you doing in that?
There's conference calls I'll use the last big one we just did. We did a mountain lion hunt in Colorado that we took a Purple Heart Marine vet from Texas on. So the way that went down is through Instagram, Robert Anthony, the head houndsman, had contacted me and offered me the lion hunt. And, well, heck yeah. And then I laid in bed that night And I shot the 30th biggest lion SCI score of all time. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, I've already got this monster lion. And I look over at my wife and I'm like, if I come home with another lion full body mount, she is not going to have it. And I said, why don't we do this for a vet hunt or a kid hunt or something like that? So I called Robert back and told him like, hey, let's do a wounded vet hunt. And this guy was fantastic. I mean, he just absolutely took the bull by the horns. So he's involved. His main guys are involved, all his houndsmen on these production meetings, Josh and Jeremy, our producer, and every single person who's going to film the hunter. We had a banquet where we raised money for the hunt, and every single piece of the puzzle is involved at some point. The nonprofit that I work with here in Green Bay, Take 'Em Outdoors, Shad, who runs that, he's involved in, I mean, so everyone knows their role going in. There's no questions as to how this goes down. And then we start doing, you know, creative, how are we going to film this? What shots do we need from everyone's perspective? Put that down into an outline. So when we get there, we already know what we need to do.
How many cameras are you talking about? Like how many cameramen? And then are you, you know, putting out GoPros? Like, is that cameraman responsible for like a GoPro as well? Or like how are you situating that?
Like for this one, Josh came and filmed it. And then there was another vet that I just kind of reached out to and networked with via Instagram that was from Colorado that came over, and he'd filmed some stuff on his own. And he literally got there and we stuck the camera in his hands. I had a weird role in this because I'm part of the hunt as, you know, in front of the camera, but I also have all my camera gear and their shots we need. So I just kind of floated to what I needed to do. If I needed to be in a shot, I was in a shot. If not, you know, I'm just, you know, stacking clips is what Josh called it. So at the end of the day, everybody would dump all their stuff into the, you know, the external. And I have, you know, we had a guy doing drone, and as the dogs are being released, and, you know, two guys in the woods, as filming hound hunting is tough because the hounds are so far ahead of you. So we would actually physically look at the tracks before we drop the dogs and get guys way into the woods, and they'd be sitting on the track so that the hounds are flying by. You got the cool shot of, you know, snow kicking and they're coming straight at you with their nose down. When we shot the lion, Josh is focused on the lion itself, but I'm behind Scott, the shooter, so I can get over his shoulder so you can see the gun and the lion. You know, so we have shots to do cutaways too. But on a typical set, two cameraman minimum. I mean, we don't have a massive budget. That's what we're banking on this season. The quality that we have, I think, is going to open some doors, and then we can afford to have that many people. I'm not going to make a dime off TV, and I'm okay with that because it's allowed me to do some pretty cool stuff and do some stuff for other people just based on the pull and the networking that you have.
Sure.
And if we can pay to do it at this level, as long as the people that I know that are worth the money to do what they're the best at, I'm happy with it.
Nice. So you drop the hounds in and you're flushing out the mountain lion. Now, I know from my experience doing, you know, hunts with dogs and stuff with hogs. I've hunted hogs with dogs before. The gentleman that I went with, he, you know, allowed me to take my bow, and, you know, I put an arrow right through the hog once the hounds had the hog, you know, bait or whatever. They didn't catch him. He didn't use catch pits or anything like that. Like, he just kind of, you know, let the hounds bay him, and then you get in close and then you finish them off with a bow. On a mountain lion hunt, how does that work? Are you using a bow? Are you getting just a rifle, or what, how you're finishing them off there?
Well, you can use either. What was funny is, so Scott being Marine and Marine mentality, our Purple Heart hunter, I give Robert his number before they met yet. So just so they can introduce themselves to each other and get to know each other. And Robert calls me like 2 hours later and he says, Scott wants to kill this thing with a spear.
I was going to ask spear, but I'm like, mountain lion, you know, you might want something a little bit more, you know, effective from a distance, but okay, keep going. We're on the same page.
I said, as much as I want to see him hunt this thing down with a spear, we've got insurance to deal with the nonprofit. You know, if he goes up that tree and the lion comes after him, I don't want to be liable. I don't want the nonprofit to be liable. I don't want you to be liable. And
right.
The craziest thing is the amount of flack you get from anti-hunters. I get things like, oh, you know, you used a gun. Why don't you make it fair and use a knife? If you would use a spear on a lion, that video would be, I don't think there'd be even some hunters that could handle what would go down, because it's going to be violent.
Right.
It's a non-win situation. So I was like, absolutely not. Bow or a gun, that's it. Pistol, I don't care what you use. We're not doing this with a spear. There's just too many headaches, too many what ifs.
Yeah, so he used a gun. I've seen that mountain lion. So he ended up using the gun.
Yeah. I mean, when you catch the lion, when you tree him, or they do bay up as well.
Right.
We were kind of on an incline coming down into this little draw, and it was pretty steep. So what was cool is you're 15 feet away, but you're at eye level. So, I mean, I was snapping stills while I could, while I had time. And then when he started getting a little, I like to use the word wonky, when an animal starts, you know, this ain't good, I'm going to bail. And then I grabbed the video camera, and I mean, you're eye to eye with this thing. I mean,
wow.
I mean, I've looked death in the face before, and that thing has all the tools, and it's right there looking at you. And one of the other hounds went around to the backside of the tree, and Robert's like, "What are you doing?" Because anytime they get shot, they come out the backside of the tree. He's like, "I'm not even going to stop shooting if it jumps on you. You know better than this."
Oh my god! Right. Jesus, man, the amount of danger and things that can go wrong. And it's funny to me that you say you look that animal in the eye and you use the phrase, it has all the tools. I don't know why that just tickles me, but it did. But the danger that goes on, you know, in something like this, but the reward, you know, and the adrenaline rush. I mean, and then at the end of the day, like you said, you're helping, you know, a Purple Heart veteran. I mean, golly, man, I can't imagine what that must feel like, you know, once it's all said and done and the success.
I told Robert and his crew before Scott got there, I said, you know, I've been doing some of these, you know, donated hunts for about a year and a half, 2 years now, and you're going to take more away from it than you ever imagined. And there was a lot of pressure. We only had 4 or 5 days, and we busted our backsides to get him one. And when we did, Robert actually broke down, and he's going to hate me for saying it, but he was so overcome with like how much work he put into it, and to see the success for the vet was huge. And you know, the relationships that are built from a bunch of strangers. My wife says all the time, she's like, "You don't know any of these people?" I'm like, "No, but I've talked to them on the phone. I can tell their character just by the phone conversation." And, you know, now he calls me, you know, 2-3 times a week, and he wants to do it. He's setting up, I got a antelope hunt that he's going to run for a girl from North Carolina that's got, she beat leukemia, and now she's got a cancerous brain tumor. And social media found out about her, called him up, called the rancher up. We got her and her dad flying out to go shoot an antelope. I mean, that one hunt for him running it for somebody else has changed him to the point he wants to do this all the time. I mean, I don't need to be the trigger puller. Being able to set these things up and being part of them, it's way more than you're continuing the traditions of hunting, but you're bringing something that when I kill something, I'm stone cold, but not because of lack of emotion, just because I'm worried about the animal expiring as efficiently as possible. I don't get rah-rah. I'm not in your face. But when I take somebody else out and they get one, I mean, I lose my mind because I'm so excited. You know, and
right. You're excited for them. I mean,
because I know how they feel because I was there once, you know, not that I don't have that same internal emotion when I do have a successful hunt for myself. It's so much more to be able to do it at this level for other people.
Yeah. And it's funny because like before I really, you know, got into this and started, you know, hunting myself. And, you know, I would watch some of these shows and not necessarily the ones where, you know, you're helping somebody out, you know, like a wounded vet or, you know, like a kid or whatever. Like I would see some of these shows with like, you know, grown, you know, normal, able-bodied people. And, you know, they'd kill a deer or like a turkey or whatever that they've been, you know, hunting for. And they would just like break down. And I'm like, what are you crying about? Like, I'm naturally like, I'm kind of like you. Like, you know, I'm not a big, you know, emotional, you know, rah-rah kind of person or whatever, but I would watch some of these shows. And I'm like, okay, what, like, why are you breaking down, you know, crying and whatnot? But I understand it a little bit better now. I'm still not a big crier or whatever, but I understand it a little bit better. It's like when you put in so much work and you put in so much time and, you know, you go through some of the challenges that we go through when we're doing this, I kind of get it now. I definitely get it, you know, with helping others. Like I said, helping, you know, like kids and vets and, you know, others less fortunate who may not have the opportunity. But man, like I said, when you go through the work and you take the time and then you finally, you know, get through on something that you worked hard for, okay, I get it now. I didn't get it at first, but I get it now.
I hear it. Absolutely.
I also noticed that you do a lot of guiding, or it says you do, you know, you guiding. Is majority of the guiding like with these nonprofits, or like are you taking others out as well, or what's your guiding consist of?
I mean, if I link up with an outfitter, let's use Turkeys and Hogs in Texas. Hey, I'm coming down for 10 days. I want to maximize the amount of footage we can get. Kills are not the main focus of a hunting show for us, but they're important. I mean, they're crucial. So I may go down for 10 days. I may hunt two where I'm in front of the camera and, you know, I shoot my hog or I shoot my turkey. I do my talking pieces. We do all the other, you know, setup and all the stuff that, you know, surrounds the hunt. But to have the other footage, I can guide the hunt and run a camera at the same time. And then I pay my way. You know, it allows me to go down there, stay there, eat, hunt, where the outfitter's getting work out of me on top of all the media stuff. So I'll run hog hunts, turkey hunts. Anytime I'm with Patrick, snow geese, ducks, I mean, I'm filming, but I'm also guiding whatever clients he may have, because a lot of the people you work with are outfitting services.
Right, right.
In some states, I'm not licensed to do it, which is actually, I think, is a good thing to bring up. I mean, you can walk down to Arkansas, pay $30 and get your snow goose guiding license and open up an outfit. And it brings in people that are money hungry and aren't doing it for the correct reasons. And it lowers the quality of the overall pool of guides. In the state of Wisconsin, in the state of Michigan, if you're going to guide ducks on a navigable waterway, you need your captain's license, which is a good right. thing, because it's just like the PHs, the professional hunters in South Africa. Those guys go through extensive schooling. But when you get somebody that's certified as a PH, you're getting somebody who's top notch, who's gone through right. the rigmarole to get to where they're at. And then some of these states where there's no regulations on it. I mean, I'm not a big government regulation guy at all. But in this case, it makes sense, because I have guys all the time that, or strangers that contact me on social media saying, hey, I want to do this hunt. And I'm like, all right, well, this is my guy. I know how he operates. I know the quality of the lodging. I know the quality of the food, which is secondary to the quality of the hunt that you're going to get. Well, he's too expensive. Well, okay, fine. And then they come back. This guy put me on one hog and he charged me a trophy fee and he charged me a skinning fee. And I'm like, hey, you're going to pay for what you get. And
right, right.
You know, guiding's not my main thing, but I see the people that I work with for a reason, because I've seen the other half of it. And it's Joe Blow, who doesn't really know what he's doing, didn't do the scouting. He's just taking the money.
Right, right. And that's, you know, for somebody like me, you know, I make no bones about it. You know, I'm in Wisconsin, you know, 6 months out of the year. I have a little place back in Georgia that's for me and my kid. But for the most of the part, I do my hunting up here in Wisconsin and in Illinois. And the value of finding a good, reputable guide, because I always looked at it like, look, I don't have time to go and scout public land. Like, that's my schedule just doesn't allow for that. So I want, you know, a reputable guide that knows what he's doing. Like, the Coast Guard certifications and stuff for duck hunts up here in Wisconsin is one of those things. I was like, okay, I understand. I get it now. And, you know, I've been fortunate that I found, you know, three or four guides that I kind of go to, you know, for deer or for, you know, goose hunting and duck hunting and stuff like that. But like you said, to have that guy that's, you know, certified, and you know you're getting quality service. So it's invaluable, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Absolutely. There's a stigma, and you'll see it on some of the hunting forums on Facebook, behind hiring a guide. And I get it, because, you know, before I got into this full time, I was like, well, I would never pay for that. And, you know, I am capable of killing any species on any continent on my own if I have the time to go there and sit behind a pair of glass and scout and get to know the animal. There's some species you can't kill because you just don't have land access. And I am perfectly willing, if I'm going to work with somebody, to sit down and just pick their brain and learn everything I can learn from somebody that does it every day, as long as right. they are that caliber of guide.
And that's also been the great thing. Like, the guys that I go with, you know, like for goose and duck hunting, I mean, for me, you know, I've gotten a little bit better at calling ducks, because I'm sitting there, you know, during the downtime, just kind of talking to them and picking their brain. And I mean, they're super cool about it. You know, they do it for a living. So it's like, why not talk to a professional? Like, my thing is, if you don't have time to scout and you want to hunt and you're not scouting, you're just pissing in the wind. So why not go with somebody that does it for a living and, you know, is reputable and is a good guy and stuff? Like I said, I'm totally about it, but I'm with you. I see, you know, all the stigmatisms and, you know, all the complaining and going back and forth on social media. And I swear, sometimes I feel like those of us in the hunting community are more of an enemy and more of a disservice to ourselves than anybody else.
I'm glad you said that. I digress.
Rant over about that.
Duck hunters happen to be, and well, waterfowlers in general. Snow goose hunters, duck and goose hunters are the worst.
Oh my God.
They are catty. And, you know, I tried kind of combating some of that stuff, and then finally got to the point where it was just not worth it. You know, hunting is not growing. It's not growing in number of people. We're losing people, and anti-hunters are going to come after us no matter what. And there's no, when it comes to online, there's nobody backing each other up, and it's all tearing people down, and it's detrimental. You know, a kid will post on there, 13-year-old kid, shoot some duck that he doesn't know what it is and post it, you know, help, asking for help on duck ID. And there's 40 guys that are 30 plus years old. I would have never shot that unless I could ID it. And like, calm down. The guy's 13. You know, if it was somebody that's right in your age demographic, okay, fine, let them have it. Like, they've never shot a duck coming in twilight hour that they couldn't tell what it is and blasted at them because a big wad came in. I mean, they're lying. Tell this kid, hey, you know, in a polite and tactful manner, you know, you should probably focus on learning duck ID before you pull the trigger, but without tearing them down. Hey, that's a black duck, or hey, that's a ring neck duck. Help them out. And it's frustrating. It's like hound hunting is a perfect example. Let's use hound hunting for bears in Wisconsin. So if someone kills a bear over bait, or someone spot and stalks one in Wisconsin, or if someone uses hounds and kills one, the anti-hunter does not care how that animal was killed, how that animal was taken. So if these guys don't band together and protect each other, if you want to kill a little bear over bait, go for it. If you want to kill a bear with hounds, that's a 20,000-year-old tradition. Go for it. Protect each other. Give each other space and respect each other. Don't go against each other. It's the join or die snake that Ben Franklin had. You know, join together or die alone. And that's what's going to happen if we keep doing this.
Because it's funny, like back home in Georgia this year, you know, they had it set up where they divided it, you know, like North Zone and South Zone. South Zone, you could bait, you know, for deer and hogs. North Zone, you could only bait for hogs. You couldn't, you know, hunt deer over bait or whatever. Well, finally, they got their act together, and now you can bait over the entire state of Georgia for deer and hogs. And people lost their mind. You can't kill a deer over corn. And if you, none of you guys ever killed a deer before until you killed it over corn. And that buck's too small. And it don't count if you killed it over bait. And, all, and I'm just like, for real? Like, this is what this is all about? And like you said, don't even get me started on duck hunters. And because I love duck hunting. I love, you know, goose hunting. But like you said, I've never seen a group that is just like, you know, they're like crabs in a barrel. And like you said, if we don't figure it out, you know, the anti-hunters, like you said, they're always going to be there, but we're going to end up destroying ourselves. So, I don't, like I said, second rant over about that. But yeah, we're on the same page about that.
Absolutely.
Here's my question, though. This is something that I want to, and I think you'll be the perfect person to answer. Turkey hunting here in Wisconsin and in Illinois, more so here in Wisconsin, obviously, because you're from here, you grew up here. What is it with the weeks, the periods? You know, like it goes from like April 17th, April 23rd is one period. And then April 24th to April 30th is another period or whatever. You know, like in Georgia and at home in South Carolina, turkey season starts March 24th. It ends May 15th.
How many birds?
That's
you get,
it.
Though?
You kill three turkeys.
Three? Okay.
Three in Georgia. Yeah. So what's the deal with the separation and how they do that? Do you understand that? Like, does it, you know, make sense to you? Cause I'm honestly just trying to understand it. I'm not knocking it. You know, obviously it's different, but I'm just trying to, you know, get an understanding.
I mean, I think it started when they had first introduced the population to regulate the number that were killed. It is convoluted. I mean, I just pulled up the sheet right now. I have week C, week D, week E for myself, week D, week E for my stepdaughter, zone two, zone two, zone two, zone three, zone three. The benefit of having this system is like, as of today, I've drawn 3 tags, 1 through the draw system and 2 leftovers. And once all the tags become leftover, I could shoot 20 turkeys in Wisconsin if you get the right tags for the and space them out in the right weeks. Why it's done by week and not, you know, here's, you get 2 birds, here's the whole season. I don't know. I don't try to figure out the DNR. I don't try to figure out anything in the government because he's just going to get mad.
That's fair. Fair enough.
I like it though. And I, like, for some reason, you know, like, I can go to Nebraska, get 3 tags and be tagged out in a weekend. It's great for an out of stater, but for an in-state tag, I mean, I'm going to have a week. I'm probably going to shoot 2 birds myself, even though I have 3 tags, and hopefully get her 2 birds. I mean, that's priority. And then we got a couple kids from Children's that were taken. You know, I've got so many options and places to go depending on what tags we need. As long as you're logged in at 10:01 when the leftovers come on sale, you'll get the tag you need.
Yeah, like I got one. I wasn't quite at 10:01, but I got one for zone 3 yesterday for one period, and I'm gonna try to get another one for another period today, just because with my schedule, I'm not sure which period I'm going to be able to hunt. And that's one thing I like about Wisconsin. At least your out-of-state tags are, you know, hunter friendly. Mm-hmm. Whereas I went across the border to Illinois the other day and tried to get over a counter tag and basically just used up a half a tank of gas because they went just like that. I mean, like, literally, Ryan, I got up, drove from Milwaukee, went across the border to the little, you know, mom and pop store to go get, you know, a tag or whatever. First of all, you can't buy them online. Illinois, what's up with that? So I drive, and I get there, and there's like 7 people already in line, and they go on sale at 8:00. And I walk in like at 7:50 thinking like, okay, you know, this is, you know, pretty good or whatever. There are already 7 people in front of me. I told one lady, I was like, I don't know if I've ever done anything like this since maybe like the first PlayStation in college, like where you just like, you get in there like super early.
When the new Jordans go on sale, and like, there's a line down the block at Foot Locker. Right.
I mean, literally, that's what drawing a turkey tag was like in Illinois. I mean, but, you know, luckily I got one so far here in Wisconsin. So hopefully I can punch that tag with my bow. But I don't know. It's different. It's definitely been a learning experience. You know, for me, you know, I think this will be like my 4th year hunting. I started late in life. You know, I grew up in the country, but I loved ATVs, but then I picked up a bow and then fell in love with it. So I mostly bow hunt. And then, you know, I'll take my shotgun and, you know, go out and with the geese and the ducks and stuff. But I'm looking forward to, you know, punching a tag on a turkey here in Wisconsin.
Zone 3 is a good zone. I got piles of tags. Are you hunting public?
Outfitter for this first one, and then depending on the time and if I draw another tag, I may try my hand on public land.
Well, if you draw another tag zone 3 on public, let me know, and I'll have secret spots.
Nice. Making connections, people. That's what the hunting life is all about, making connections.
It really is.
Couple more, and then I'm going to get you out of here. What's your favorite species to hunt? Do you have a favorite species?
Oh, that's a really good question. To hunt or just an animal in general?
Let's start with hunt and then animal in general.
I mean, I'm a waterfowler first.
Okay.
Ducks is my thing. I was lucky to have been able to go to St. Paul Island, which is 3 hours from the mainland into the Bering Sea.
Oh, wow.
Out of Alaska this January with King Eider Adventures and film and get to shoot my birds. So I got to shoot a King Eider and some King Eiders and some Harlequins. And I mean, that's the pinnacle of waterfowl. It's funny that you say, you know, like when people get emotional, I'm not. But when I put that first King Eider in my hands, I looked at the camera, I was like, cut. Like, stop. Because it was that is the pinnacle of waterfowl. And I lost a real good friend who had organized our veterans duck hunt in Horicon in this last summer. And I always duck hunted, but I wasn't a duck hunter until I went to that veterans duck hunt. And now I'm part of it. I'm on the board. And, you know, we've grown this thing from 6 vets to 80 vets every year. And Ryan Voy, who passed away, you know, I was in his boat the first year, and that changed me into a waterfowler. And to hold that duck in my hand, it hit me that, like, you know, he's gone, but I'm here, and he's with me. And I got a little, I choked out some words for the camera, and I was like, shut that thing off right now.
Yeah.
So the King Eider was my favorite hunt so far by far. dangerous too. I mean, you're in a 10-foot dinghy in the same waters that the guys from Deadliest Catch are out there battling for crabs, and you're like, this is stupid, but I'm doing it.
Wow, man, that does sound pretty exciting. So okay, so that's your, you know, favorite species, favorite weapon.
Individual firearm?
Yeah, individual firearm. Well, let's start with, are you more of a firearm guy, or are you a big bow guy?
Time is of the essence, so I'd usually use a rifle and shotgun. But favorite firearm is the Mark 19 grenade launcher, which is the coolest thing ever. Somebody was sitting there and was like, you know what? What if I made a machine gun grenade launcher? So that's my favorite firearm. I mean, I usually use a 30-06, which is just a utility rifle for just about everything. Everything I shot in Africa when I went was with a 30-06 and put them all down.
Nice, clean, and tried and true, the old 30-06.
Every species I shot over there went down in one, except for the wildebeest is a bullet-eaten SOB. I put one through both lungs and he ran a quarter mile. I put another one through his front shoulder and he ran a half mile, and then he finally went down and I had to shoot him one more time. And I mean, three kill shots.
Good grief.
I was like, it was like a boxer that's on the ropes, you know, like they're down and somehow they stagger to their feet. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Just an impressive animal.
Wow. And then think about that. Now you put three kill shots, like you said, through that. And then you got lions that go and then they know how to bring that animal down and finish them off. And then it's just something about like that comparison and how that works. That's just, it's amazing.
Do you know what a caracal is?
Three kill shots.
It's called a caracal cat. It's the size of a bobcat. It's a little more.
I'm not familiar.
It's a little more slender than a bobcat. It's shorter hair because it's South African climate. So this thing, size of a bobcat, takes down a full grown kudu bull. It jumps up and bites it in the neck and rides it down. It's incredible.
Jesus, yeah, man, wow. So now, what is next? Like you said before, you know, you're always, you know, you're not a complacent guy. You're not, you know, going to stand still. What's next for you? What you got coming up?
Well, with this baby coming, this is my first biological child. I got all kinds of stuff to figure out how to be a a father of a newborn. My 9-year-old step. Thank you. I'm so excited. My 9-year-old stepdaughter is going to hunt turkeys with me this spring because mom can't say no if I'm bringing her. You need to be home with baby. I'm like, I'm taking nice. your other kid out. So she's going to shoot a turkey on her great-grandfather's farm just outside of Green Bay. We're going to do a bunch of turkey hunts around here. And then I told her I would stay home all summer for sure. I'm not going to book anything, plan anything up until September. Then we're looking at doing some hog hunting in September. And then my calendar, it goes absolutely berserk. October, November, December, January, February. October, I'm shooting my first bull elk in Idaho. We have the Veterans Duck Hunt, 10th annual in Horicon. November, we're doing a veterans hunt in Texas for ducks. The second annual veterans lion hunt in Colorado. December, I'm going after ducks in Utah and possibly running a vets duck hunt in Maine for sea ducks. And then January, I'm going to be hanging out with Brian Hardy from Hardy Face Paint, and he's going to get me on three ducks that I haven't shot yet in Florida, the Whistling Frivolous Duck, mottled duck, and a ringneck duck. So I'm jam packed up until then.
I was about to say you don't have any space in your book there, bro.
And when I'm home, I best be doing everything to stay on her good graces.
yes, you should. Ryan, I appreciate the time, man. I'm glad we got a chance to talk and link up. It's amazing how this world, the longer you stay around, it kind of gets smaller and smaller. I mean, like I said, you're childhood friends with one of my best robotic camera operators, that I work with down here in Milwaukee. And we just kind of, you know, talk back and forth. And he's always, you know, kind of been a really good supporter of my brand since I started it when I moved here to work here in Milwaukee. And we always always talk back and forth about little hunting stuff here and there. And then, you know, he was telling me about you a couple of years ago. And then now, you know, I'm talking to you. And then we also have another mutual friend that we just found out about, you know, out of the blue. So I really appreciate you taking the time and coming on the podcast, man.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Before you get out of here, let the people know where they can find you at. Buddha.
Ryan Off the Grid on Instagram and Facebook, Ryan Off the Grid. And then our nice. Pursuit channel this April and May. It's called Backcountry Traditions.
Awesome. Awesome. And all those links, I'll make sure I post those links in the description when this podcast drops. Ladies and gentlemen, Ryan the Buddha. Man, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, now I want to say thank you again to Ryan the Buddha for joining me on the Bryantland Country Podcast. We recorded that podcast a couple weeks ago, so I believe turkey season may not have been in yet that point. We record these podcasts, you know, like sometimes 2-3 weeks in advance, just so I can kind of stay, you know, above water with these. So then I try to update the intros and outros so they'd be a little bit less dated with the podcast. But you guys don't seem to care because you've been listening, you've been supporting. But I figured I'd kind of just give you a little peek behind the curtain, if you will. Speaking of dated material or updated material, we're going to start putting out bonus episodes of the Bryantland Country Podcast. They will come out at random times. I will definitely give you guys a heads up, more so a lot on Instagram, some on Facebook and Twitter, but for the most part on Instagram, at Official Bryantland, by the way, on Instagram. If you're not following, you need to be. I will give you guys a heads up when those bonus episodes drop. It'll probably be every 2 weeks, and they will be, like I said, a little bit more timely with stuff that's going on that week or, you know, within that day. So be on the lookout for that. And those bonus episodes will cover some of everything. They'll cover sports, they'll cover ATV stuff, you know, obviously more hunting stuff, but a lot more random things as well in the bonus episodes. Maybe even talk some wrestling, you know, no telling. Okay. But I want to start putting out a bonus episode, you know, like I said, every couple of weeks for you guys. You guys have supported the podcast, and I feel like I owe it to you to give you some more updated material. So there you go. Before I get out of here, though, I want to throw a couple more things at you. Make sure you're checking out our videos on the on-demand tab of the BryantlandCountry.com website, our videos, and then make sure you are checking out Bryantland Shop, the shop tab on the BryantlandCountry.com website. Get you a hat, t-shirt. Mother's Day coming up, Father's Day coming up. Go ahead and get those gifts. Be proactive. So make sure you're checking that out. Thank you again for all your support. Thank you for supporting the podcast. I'm going to go ahead and get out of here, and I'll catch y'all next week on another episode of the Bryantland Country Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Bryantland Country Podcast, hosted by AB3. Please leave us a positive review and 5-star rating on iTunes. Be sure to check out our podcast section on our website, BryantlandCountry.com, for previous podcasts. Check us out on Instagram at Official Bryantland and Twitter at 3Bryantland. This has been an AB3 Media Production. Join us next time for another edition of the Bryantland Country Podcast.